Welcome to ICTJ's podcast. On Tuesday, August 7th, the ICC in The Hague ordered that reparations be given to the victims in the case of Thomas Lubanga. Lubanga was recently convicted by the court for war crimes dealing with the use of child soldiers in hostilities in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. This is the first time that the ICC has made a decision to award reparations, and it is a major moment for international justice. Here to give us insight on this important decision is Ruben Carranza. He is the director of ICTJ's Reparative Justice Program. He works with victims, communities, and reparations policymakers around the world, as well as providing advice on issues involving reparations and war crimes tribunals, including in Cambodia, as well as the ICC. Ruben, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So Tuesday's decision from the ICC were on the principles that are to be applied to reparations for victims. Can you tell us about the content of this decision, and how do you think it will affect victims in this case?
First, the most important point to emphasize is that the decision itself did not award material or symbolic reparations to the victims. That is not to say that the order does not lead to reparations for victims. Second, and to clarify what I just said, the decision does four things. First two are that it recognizes the right to reparations, and I'll elaborate on why that's very, very important. The second is it establishes the process by which the court will then lead to awarding reparations to victims. The other two things that the court did, or effectively did not do in the decision was, as I said, not to award reparations to those who had already applied for reparations to the court directly. Second, the court declined to specifically order the trust fund for victims to implement any specific forms of reparations coming from the funds that the trust fund has generated for reparations purposes. And I'll also elaborate on that. The court first laid down the principles on reparations that the Rome Statute requires it to do. And this laying down of principles on reparations has been one of the, in a sense, contentious questions on reparations in the ICC. Earlier, the issue was whether the court should lay down principles that would govern reparations issues in all cases that come before the court, even before the court decides on any pending criminal case before it, or whether the court should wait for a criminal case to actually be decided and then lay down principles on reparations. That question is important because it meant that the court would either in advance say how reparations would work in the Rome Statute, or the court would have to take into account each context that comes before it and then decide on reparations. In this decision, the court lays down 14 principles on reparations, and many of these principles are taken from the practice of states, from the practice of transitional justice. And some of them are taken from human rights conventions and other decisions of other tribunals. But at the same time, the court says in this decision that these principles only apply to this case. So there's, I think, a positive side to that. The court lays down principles. But there's also a side to it that may have been expressed in a clearer way by the court. Why would the court lay down principles, but at the same time say that they only apply to this case?
So what are the challenges that the court could run into in the future, given that it hasn't laid out principles for all of its cases?
Because it is a court, those who come before it expect a court, such as the ICC, to have rules and expect to be able to cite not only those rules, but how the court has previously interpreted rules. In other words, the notion of precedent. So if these principles apply only in this case, it still remains to be asked whether the same principles ought to be applied in succeeding cases. I don't see why not, but that's still something we will see in the future. The other equally important principles that the court laid down was first recognizing that there is a right to reparations. The court was very explicit saying that. I think that's very important because while there have been various human rights treaties and different resolutions from the United Nations, for example, that talk about the right to reparations, having that right recognized by an international court such as the ICC not only reinforces the existence of that right, but strengthens its enforceability. In other words, that it's not only a hollow recognition, but that victims can actually go to court and ask for the right to be enforced. Another important principle that the court enunciated in this decision is the recognition of the right of victims to participate in the process of reparations design and implementation. There are other principles that the court enunciated. Many of them are principles that really reflect the way reparations has been practiced elsewhere, particularly in countries that have undergone transitional justice processes. But some of the more important principles that I think should be emphasized in the way that the court recognized them are, first, the court recognized the existence of a human right to reparations. I think that is very important because it not only recognizes the right, but because it comes from the International Criminal Court, it means that victims can now really have that right enforced under the Rome Statute. Second, the court recognized victim participation as an important principle in the reparations process before the court. In context of transitional justice, post-conflict or post-authoritarian, we have always emphasized the importance of designing a reparations program that allows victims to participate at the earliest possible stage, all the way up to implementing and monitoring the implementation of the program. And it's important that that is reflected in the court's decision. The court also emphasized the importance of including women and other marginalized populations in the process of designing and implementing reparations programs. Again, this is taken from the practice of the few reparations programs that have been implemented in non-court contexts, and it's good to see this reflected in the practice of the court.
And of course, victim participation has always been a major concern for the ICC. So do you think that this reparations process maybe could serve as a way to re-invite victims to participate in a process with the court?
It should, but at the same time, I would say that the court has been cautious, perhaps to the point of being too cautious in its approach to this aspect of victim participation. In its decision, the court recognized that there were victims who applied for reparations under the Rome Statute, because the Rome Statute allows them to do that. The court recognized that these victims applied for individual reparations, but at the end of the decision, the court said that it would not examine these applications and that it would instead turn them over to the Trust Fund for Victims. That exhibits caution. The court correctly did not want to act on the number of applications for reparations that were already before it, without knowing the number of applications for reparations that would come after this decision. But I also think that there is overcautiousness there, because the court could have taken a few steps that recognized those victims who had already come before it, acknowledged their victimization, especially since many of them were direct victims. In other words, victims of forced recruitment, of the crime for which Tomas Lubanga was convicted. And so there could have been an effort to even symbolically recognize that. Of course, the court said the judgment of conviction itself is a way of symbolically recognizing their status. But I think there can be something more than that. The second aspect to victim participation that's important is that the court has allowed the Trust Fund for Victims to effectively manage this process. The court said that the trust fund can now proceed to take five steps as part of this entire process of reparations implementation. First, the trust fund will constitute a group of experts to identify the harms and the localities that should be the focus of determining who will get reparations and what kind. The court then said that the trust fund, through these experts, including experts from the DRC, can then identify the localities themselves and hear victims from those localities and understand what they expect and need as reparations. The third step would be for the trust fund to then design a program or a set of programs based on the hearings and assessment that it can do with victims for the court to approve. And then the court will then go over the plan that the trust fund will submit and decide, perhaps approve or even just monitor its implementation.
Right, and you mentioned the trust fund is going to essentially handle all of these requests. And the trust fund for victims, of course, was set up by the court's Assembly of States parties, and so far it has been operating on its first mandate, its assistance mandate. So the trust fund has really had direct contact with all of these communities. Do you foresee any challenges with the trust fund handling these cases, particularly because of the limited resources available? Of course, the trust fund depends on the contributions of donors, particularly states who are parties of the statute. So are there any concerns there that this could maybe fall victim to some kind of political process or the victims won't receive enough compensation?
First, on the funding, the trust fund relies extensively on voluntary contributions. The only other source of funding for reparations would be assets of the perpetrator that have been seized, identified, and then forfeited. But the trust fund cannot do that by itself. It will have to rely on the court. And in this case of Tomas Lubanga, for example, even after several years of trying to identify assets that can be forfeited, the prosecutor came back and said they could not find any, which I think is indicative more of the lack of resources at finding assets than the lack of assets itself. The voluntary contributions to the trust fund have increased in the last couple of years, but it's difficult to know how much the trust fund needs since it's impossible to know in advance how many victims and what kind of violations the trust fund would have to deal with. The second point on the relationship between the court and the trust fund has also to be understood properly. The trust fund is not a unit within the court. It is an institution separately created by the Rome Statute, and therefore it has its own existence, it follows its own rules, and it reports to the Assembly of States parties. So it's important for the Assembly of States parties to directly and significantly support the trust fund, and part of that support should be translated in terms of funding. The court was careful in this decision to say that the voluntary contributions that go to the trust fund can be the source of reparations ordered by the court, that it's not just the trust fund that decides what to do with that fund. But the court was also careful in saying at the end of its decision that it wasn't going to order the trust fund to spend it in one way or another, that it would in fact leave the trust fund to decide how best to spend its resources. I should add that the court emphasized community reparations, but it also relied heavily on what the trust fund said might be a feasible approach to reparations in this case.
One of the major criticisms that has arisen in the Lubanga case from the outside community is that the prosecution did not include charges of sexual violence against Lubanga, and he was not convicted of any charges of sexual violence. And yet this reparations decision by the court on Tuesday extensively refers to the fact that there are specific crimes of a sexual nature that must be considered when reparations are issued to victims. So could you explain to us a little bit how that process works, and how is it that when issuing a decision on reparations, the judges can include a discussion of taking sexual violence into consideration, and yet those crimes aren't included in the conviction.
The very positive aspect of the decision when it comes to dealing with sexual violence and more generally with gender questions is that the court did not feel that it was constrained by the decision of the prosecutor not to charge sexual crimes when it came to deciding on reparations. I think it's important. It's important because even without saying so, the court is actually agreeing that the right to reparations is independent of the guilt or innocence of the convicted person. Of course, in the Rome Statute, the victims will most likely not get reparations if the accused is acquitted. But having said that, the right to reparations in general isn't actually dependent on either identifying, arresting, prosecuting, or convicting the perpetrator. Victims are entitled to reparations regardless of what happens to the criminal accountability part of that process. The court did not explicitly justify its approach that way. But by going straight into and talking about dealing with sexual violence and gender considerations, the court is effectively saying that the right to reparations covers a broader range of issues, deals with harm to victims that shouldn't be subjected to the narrow considerations of the prosecutor's strategy.
You talk about the right to reparations and how important it is that victims understand that access to compensation for their suffering is a right. What is the experience of these victims in situations when they realize that reparations is in fact a right?
Saying that reparations is a right and translating that so that it responds to the needs of victims of human rights violations, there's a big gap between those and the practice outside of the ICC has not exactly completely filled that gap. In other words, while we've seen post-conflict countries, post-dictatorship countries establish truth commissions or go through trials of perpetrators, and we've seen truth commissions and courts order reparations or recommend reparations, we have seen very few countries in which reparations have actually been implemented. South Africa, for example, went through a truth commission process, but the government of South Africa hasn't exactly followed the recommendations of the truth commission on reparations. And even up to now, you still have issues around the limited number of persons that the South African government provided compensation to, notwithstanding the recommendation of the Truth Commission. You still have debates elsewhere over what kind of violations should be prioritized by reparations programs. And so the recognition of the right to reparations is one thing. How that is fulfilled is another. Now, that's particularly problematic in post-conflict developing countries such as the DRC. In the DRC, the legal system actually allows victims to go to court, ask for reparations, especially if the perpetrators are agents of the state. But as one of our studies on reparations in the DRC has indicated, of all the major cases in which victims went to court, asked for reparations in the DRC for violations committed by Congolese soldiers, none have actually received reparations despite winning in court. For victims, then, it's important not only to recognize the right to reparations, but to actually make it happen. In this case, while it's important to acknowledge that for the first time, the ICC has recognized the right to reparations in a very specific way with respect to a specific group of victims, it will be important for those supporting the ICC those who are interested in international justice to ensure that it goes beyond celebrating this milestone, that things should go beyond recognizing a step as being historically significant, because it may not yet be that significant for those who actually should receive reparations.
And my last question, is ICTJ planning on working with the ICC or with the Trust Fund for Victims as it begins this very important process of implementation?
We have worked with the Trust Fund in the last several years, including responding to Trust Fund requests for us to comment on and assess their work. We've worked with them in Uganda. We've worked with them in their planning of assistance programs. And we work with them regularly in the way they approach questions before the court on reparations. We hope to be able to assist the Trust Fund through the DRC program in identifying experts that can help them in the five-step process that the court has said it should follow to implement reparations. We hope to work with the Trust Fund in expanding on the principles of reparations that the court pronounced in this case. The court, for example, cites the Nairobi Declaration on the Right of Women and Girls to Reparations. What's important about the Nairobi Declaration is that this is not a treaty, this is not a UN declaration, this is not, in fact, a legal instrument among governments, but a declaration of civil society organizations and victims groups. And it takes many steps toward reparations that are in many ways more progressive than what governments usually agreed on. And I think that's important. And the fact that the court cites the Nairobi Declaration, to me, is one of the most significant aspects of this decision. The other significant aspect of the decision that the Trust Fund will need to elaborate on, and which ICTJ ought to be able to support, is in how the court recognized forms of reparations such as compensation, restitution, rehabilitation, and at the same time interpreted these forms in ways that are just as progressive and as transformative as the Nairobi Declaration, for example. For instance, in talking about restitution, the court did not only say that restitution is a form of reparations, but the court said that restitution will only be meaningful if it does not only restore the victim to a status in which the victim was already discriminated, the victim was already marginalized, and the victim was already excluded, because then restitution would not be meaningful at all, would not amount to justice for the victim. And I think that's a very important statement coming from the court, because it doesn't only pay lip service to the idea of restitution, but elaborates on restitution. Now, how will the Trust Fund for Victims translate that? What does that mean for a Congolese victim? What does restitution look like for a child who was recruited who's now an adult, or for a girl who was recruited, a victim of sexual violence, who has no access to healthcare? Do you go back to the old situation where there was no access to healthcare in the first place? Do you go back to a situation where you could be recruited precisely because there were no other opportunities for you to find a means of living? So how this will work out, I think, is very important. And I think this is one of the ways in which ICTJ should be able to help.
Well, very, very interesting issues at hand, and we will keep our listeners up to date on the developments in the reparations awards for the victims. And if you would like to find out more about ICTJ's work, either in its reparative justice program or on anything related to ICTJ's work with the ICC, you can visit our website at www.ictj.org. Ruben, thank you so much for talking with us.